You know what's really funny? I notice that whenever we get new listeners, all of a sudden we have like all these clicks and all these listens of all of our old episodes, and you know that it's somebody who went, "Oh my God, I found the people who understand me." And it makes me think
I
like,
found my people. I love
what is
that
going to be
too.
the platform where finally we are exposed to the world?
It's true. We are looking for a way to expose ourselves.
Like the day of the Iowa caucus, we got so many listens to the Bernie episode. Like,
Oh, awesome.
it was
We also got some hate tweets. I don't know if you noticed on
Finally,
that one.
finally. I feel like we've been trolling the Bernie bros forever,
I
waiting for
know,
them
we've
to
really
find
been
us. We're like,
trying to
come on,
provoke
guys.
them.
So, no, but I feel like I want enough listeners out there so that when the revolution happens and the fascists come, they kill us, okay? Right now, we're kind of under the radar.
I've
Like,
always said I want to die in the first wave. I don't want to be one of the survivors who envies the dead. Are you okay?
it's true, though. It's so true.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Grant.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
I don't know that we can ruin impeachment because it's ruined America. Like, what are we going to ruin?
We
What can
cannot.
we do with this?
There is nothing left to ruin. We'll analyze how impeachment has ruined us.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. And ruined the country. I mean, ruined us. Like, it's ruined so much more.
Yeah. Before we get into what we want to talk about with regard to impeachment, let's check in with each other and share some news and updates and stuff. Maya, how are you doing? How is your artist residency going?
It's full of art. It's full of silence. It's full of awesome things. I have so many things to share with you guys, but I can't yet because if I tell you, then it's not going to happen because I'm superstitious because I'm a Jew. But there are things that are very exciting that are cooking right now.
That's really mysterious and intriguing. And I have seen your Instagram, so I know you're not making shit up. You're doing it up artsy fartsy
It's
style.
really, really good. Now, one thing I want to, so I've been drinking a bunch of tequila and soda all night because there's an event here, which you might hear in the background. I'm sorry, guys. There are
Yeah,
a
well, I
bunch
was
of.
going to say, it doesn't sound so silent.
Well, tonight is one of those fancy, you know, fancy Charlotte people come to see what the artists do. And
Oh.
They're all here. They're all drinking. It means the booze has been free and flowing. So I'm kind of at a three already. So let's see where this shit goes tonight.
All right.
Now you have a very nice cocktail glass. That's very nice. And there's some brown liquid in it. So I'm saying it's a Manhattan.
It does look like a Manhattan, but it is not because I am still on my cleanse, quote unquote cleanse, by which I mean that I am not drinking beer, wine, or sugary cocktails. For me, that's a
I
cleanse.
love that that's a
What?
cleanse. That's like amazing.
No, I'm just drinking scotch. It's Talisker Storm,
I love
and
Talisker.
I put it in the cocktail glass because I just got these new cocktail glasses and I really wanted to use them.
Is there something
So
float? Is that ice?
maybe you're seeing the seam of the plastic that the glass is
Oh,
made out of.
plastic.
I had to buy, I gave in and bought unbreakable cocktail glasses. I was literally shopping to replace our cocktail glasses because I had broken so many of them. We no longer had a set. So I decided that these actually are kind of cute if you kind of squint and hold it in just the right light and just the right angle.
Yeah, but
You can't
I
quite
feel
tell that
like
it's plastic.
drinking out of glass is better. I even feel that way about drinking tea. Like I've gotten these little glass teacups that are like clear glass. Like it's just
No, I know what you mean.
better. It's better.
Drinking out of glass is
Superior.
better.
Now I'm drinking out of these very fancy solo cups. They're like solo cups. They're like red solo cups, except they're gold. Because
Yeah.
it's for fancy people.
They're the most elegant solo cups I've ever seen, I have to tell you. I didn't even know they came in
We got to
gold.
keep up with the fancies.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we just watched the Oscars, and we're going to talk about that in a second.
Yes.
Let's talk about listener feedback.
Yes.
I just wanted to mention a tweet that we got from Molly Blue Dawn,
I
who's
love Molly.
I know. We love Molly. At What Molly Said on Twitter.
Go follow her. She's awesome.
And she sent a link to a Far Side cartoon that is originally from 1987. The cartoon is a picture of an amoeba wearing a cowboy hat and carrying a lasso. And the caption is like, "And until next week, partners, adios, amoebas." So she recognized that that's where I got the saying adios amoebas, which is the phrase I have used on departing every situation in my entire life ever since I saw that comic sometime in the late 80s.
Well done, Molly. Thank you.
Good sleuthing there, Molly Blue Dog.
I want to be part of your coven.
Yeah, Molly's one of our witchy followers, I get the sense. We welcome witches here at the Sauce.
We are witches. We are a coven.
Yeah, I mean, all women are, but yeah. We're like one of the good ones, good covens.
Also, one of our listeners, Arnim Summer, asked us if we could ruining Trump. Arnim, that's an amazing question. I think that that's really important, and we're going to have to get into that.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea to ruining Trump. And I think the time for it has come.
Oh my God, it is now.
I don't know. We got to get into it sometime soon. So thank you for that suggestion.
It's a great suggestion. Also, we have to just briefly talk about the fact that Parasite, a South Korean movie about class warfare, essentially, swept the Oscars?
Yeah.
And it's like, was the best movie of the year, and they recognized it as the best movie of the year. These people voted for Green Book last year.
Well, see, the thing is, that's why you kind of have to take everything with that grain of salt. It's like, oh, yay, they recognized Parasite, but these are the same people who thought Green Book was the best movie made in 2018. The best of all the movies. They were
Green
like,
Book.
Green Book. Green
oh, yeah,
Book
that
is
one.
That. So it's like, how much does it mean when they honor Parasite? I mean, we did talk about this in our Oscars episode, how these people still are gatekeepers, and a lot of decisions about what movies are going to be made and a lot of access that artists and filmmakers and creative people have to the resources of Hollywood are going to be inflected and influenced by how the Oscars turn out. So it does matter in a certain way. But it is really odd. Because it's so rare. It is so rare that the actual best movie of the year gets awarded the Best Picture Oscar.
And
that never happened.
And also to beat Scorsese and to beat Quentin Tarantino doing his like blowjob for the Oscars. Like,
I'll tell you what though, watching the Oscars telecast, the moment when I knew Parasite was going to win Best Picture was when Brad Pitt, early on, it was like one of the first awards, he was accepting his Best Supporting Actor award. And he said, like, I just have to thank Quentin. And like two people applauded. Yes. Yeah, there was this really muted spattering of applause. And then when Parasite was mentioned for any nomination, it got a roar in the auditorium. And I was like, oh, wow, okay. Parasite might actually win.
Parasite parodies the people in that audience, like, do they not know? Or do they think that by liking that movie, they are not those people?
I think either they don't know, or it's like, the more enthusiastic you are for this movie, the more you're showing that you definitely get it. You get it. You're not one of those bad rich people. You're a cool rich people.
But that's the thing. It's not that it ruined Parasite for me, because it's such a good movie. But I found myself disoriented and uncomfortable because it made me feel like, what's wrong here that people are acknowledging the actual best movie of the year for best movie of the year?
Yeah.
What's going on? Because I am so used to the Oscars not being that. I'm so used to it. And you know where it started for me is when that fucking cunt Gwyneth Paltrow won for best actress when that should have been Kate Blanchett for Elizabeth.
So I guess you're not watching the Goop Lab on Netflix. No.
You know what? Why should we ruin Gwyneth Paltrow? She is ruined. There is nothing good about her.
She's ruined. Though I've been tempted to watch an episode of it just
to see.
For shits and giggles. Just to see. I was actually looking back at recent Oscar Best Picture winners just to see if my sort of conventional wisdom about what Oscar goes for, what the Academy likes, might be off.
Yes.
And I'm going to admit that over the past maybe 5 or 6 years, they have actually gone in different directions than you might expect. I mean, last year, okay, was Green Book. Fine. Before that was The Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
Which I didn't see. And
she's fucking a fish. I mean,
yeah, she's fucking a fish. I'm really not that interested, but I appreciate he's a director of color. It's a artistic kind of movie. The year before that, Moonlight.
Yeah.
Year before that, Spotlight. Okay. That's pretty conventional Oscar material, but it's not like totally like epic, you know, 3 hour historical drama.
It was actually, Spotlight is a very tight, well done procedural drama. It's like, it's solid. It's solid.
It's just a solid procedural. Yeah. Before that is Birdman. Yeah. Oh, did you see that one? Oh, God.
But that's because it's just the most misogynist fucking trash.
I mean, maybe that was where they got that out of their system. The aging Hollywood feeling left behind. So they didn't have to give it to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Ugh. You know, I bet people could see Parasite as like, because the women in it are all such brutal and wonderfully grotesque characters that maybe they see it from their own misogyny and not from how richly empathetic it was to all of these different women.
That's a really interesting thought. Yeah, I don't know that being misogynistic is necessarily a requirement, but I will say
it helps.
That it helps. And there's not a lot of lady-centered movies here on this list of nominees, much less winners of Best Picture. Prior to Birdman was 12 Years a Slave, which, hey, it's about people of color. Before that, Argo. And before Argo, The Artist, both of which are about Hollywood. Like, Argo is about Hollywood saving the day.
Right.
And The Artist is just about, oh, movie magic is wonderful.
I felt like Parasite was undeniable in its brilliance, but I don't think that that's why it won. I think it won because people can feel like in this Trump era, it's their way of showing that they get it. But the same people who voted for Green Book last year, maybe when they voted for Green Book, they think that they're being righteous and woke. And they're not.
They're definitely not. But I don't know. All I'm saying is I think that up until around Argo, which was like 2003 or 4, up until there, it's pretty Oscar-y. And then I think after that, it becomes a little less predictable. And in the last like 5 years, I mean, I would never have predicted that Moonlight would ever win Best Picture, for example.
It was supposed to be La La Land. Yeah, totally.
Right, right. So,
well, all I'm saying is,
maybe things are changing.
No. I'm saying that there was something very disorienting about seeing the actual legitimate best thing be recognized as the best thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that we just ruined Parasite winning, even though it gave me great pleasure. But it also made me feel like if Parasite can win, Warren can win.
Oh, God.
If we can go from Green Book to Parasite.
That's a wonderful thought.
I have to, or else I'm going to fucking die right now. Shit is so bad. I can't, you know.
Let's stop discussing this topic now because I just want to leave on that happy thought. All right. We have to go from happy thoughts to our main topic.
Because we have to talk about the impeachment. We can't, like, let it go by.
Yeah, but I think that our interest here isn't so much in the actual events of the impeachment as it is looking at the GOP, both the GOP in the Senate and in all positions of government and power, and the GOP electorate and the media, the conservative media, and the way that they managed to stick by Trump in the face of undeniable evidence of inexcusable actions. I think especially when you look at figures like, you know, Collins and the people who are supposed to be so-called moderates.
They're also supposed to be like the adults in the room.
The adults in the room, yeah. But they're singing their little song about how they're really going to consider things, and then they just do exactly what all the other GOP senators do, whatever Mitch McConnell asks them to do.
You know what? I was talking to some friends who do policy work, mm-hmm. and, you know, they're doing a lot of work in D.C., and they were telling me that their friends who are in D.C. are like, McConnell is a machine.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't give a shit what you say about him. He doesn't give a shit. He's, focused.
I've always kind of grudgingly respected him, though I think he is way more evil and way more dangerous than Trump. Trump is nothing without McConnell. Like,
yeah.
McConnell is the evil here. And, you know, in retrospect, it was evident early on, and it's frustrating that it's come to this. But a very telling moment happened in Trump's speech that he was giving in the White House the day after the acquittal.
Mm.
He gave that rambling, crazy-ass speech.
Sundowning. And, like,
yeah,
fucking...
I didn't watch any video of it, but I read the transcript because I was curious. And he is just naming people throughout their speech. He's naming all the people. He's giving thanks to all the different senators and all the lawyers and all the different people that helped with getting him acquitted from impeachment. And every time he mentions Mitch McConnell, he says, "You can't read that guy. That guy's got a poker face. You can't read him." And I thought that was really interesting. The outstanding feature of Mitch McConnell to Donald Trump is that he can't read him. Like, Donald Trump is someone who thinks he can manipulate people.
Yeah.
He thinks he's got people figured out. Once he meets you, he gets a little assessment of you. You know, he looks you up and down and he gets a sense of what you want. And then he promises you what you want. He does what a con man does. That's what a con man does. It's the one thing he's probably good at. And you
can see.
So
the one thing he respects is somebody who he knows is beyond his ability to manipulate.
And he respects it. He's afraid of it. You can tell. He's a little bit like put off by it. Like, he has no category to put Mitch McConnell in.
Because he knows that if Mitch decides otherwise,
that he's fucked.
He's out. He's fucked 100%.
Exactly. I thought that was very telling.
But then also what's really interesting about that is that after the impeachment, like, the impeachment happens and whatever, it's like this kabuki performance. Everybody's doing their like kabuki performance. Adam Schiff was great, by the way. All of the House impeachment managers call all of their offices and say thank you. Like,
thank you.
They
that
need to hear
amazing.
It.
They probably do.
They probably do need to hear it.
I know I would want to hear it.
Oh my God, right. So I think what's interesting is that there's this way that after he gets acquitted, mm-hmm. he's free to do all kinds of crazy shit. Which, like, he fired Vindman, he fired Sondland, he's trying to lessen Roger Stone's sentence. Like,
the fat
is on the fire. This shit is out. But then it's also people like Susan Collins being like, I'm sure he's learned his lesson. Oh. It's like, what lesson did he learn? He learned that he could do things that are unimaginably corrupt and have them in the public eye and get away with them.
That's exactly
correct.
That's
the lesson he learned.
He learned it. Mitch McConnell learned it several years ago with the Merrick Garland nomination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably learned it before then, but he really tested it at that point. He was just like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do what I want to do. And no one forced him out or held him to account for that. So here we are.
Okay. I have a question here for us.
Okay.
How can we even break this down, because it's so horrifying, and it makes me wonder, like, is this a moment where we should look at the assumptions that we have of how power should work so that we can understand how terrible this is? Like, there's a way that I feel like I really believed in this idea, and maybe it's my own like white naivete, that there's like a structure,
mm-hmm.
there are rules,
there's these institutions. There are norms and laws and rules that govern how they operate.
And people work at the edges of them, and they work the edges of them. But at a certain point, if you are like Randy Duke Cunningham taking hundreds of thousands of dollars for like the Dukester, your boat, mm-hmm. with all kinds of shit, that's going to be a problem for you at some point. Or like, there's this feeling, and you even feel it right now where you have like Duncan Hunter and mm-hmm. like Chris Collins. There are sitting Republican congressmen being indicted for their illegal actions. You feel like there are rules And if you break the rules and you're shown to have broken the rules, something will happen. And I think that what's so disorienting about this moment, and it's maybe it's my own naivete and my own access to power that I can feel like that. It's breaking all that. Like, it doesn't matter. Rules and what we say are the rules don't matter. And that's what's crazy about the Republicans. Everything they have ever hung their hat on for decades, for our entire adult life, actually, since we were teenagers, everything that they tried to use as the fucking thing to like burn the Democrats on, like, shouldn't these be the rules? Shouldn't these be our morals? Shouldn't we care about this?
Shouldn't these be the standards we live by, our values?
All of them. All of them. And it doesn't matter.
So that's the question I really want to get to. Why? How? How is it that I don't even know how to articulate this. The deepest values that you would think that conservative Christians hold, the most essential foundational, like, rock upon which economic conservatism is built, anything that you would think that the GOP believe in, they are, like, willing to compromise.
Foreign policy, no. Like,
fuck all of that. They will throw any of that out the window. They will agree to anything, defend anything, justify anything in defense of Trump. And so I want to get to this question of fucking why. We are at the point where it's pretty evident that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and he was absolutely right. His followers, his fans, the conservative media, and the GOP government establishment would all stick by him.
Well, here's the other thing. The percentage of Americans who support Trump is not anywhere near the majority. So no, that's the other thing that you expect to be a check.
Yeah, but Hitler never got a majority of votes from anyone.
Oh, he brought in Hitler. Didn't. You brought in Hitler.
I. It's no longer a rule. What is it, the Godwin rule? That you, like, once you bring up Hitler, you've, like, ruined the whole conversation. It's not a rule anymore. Like, you have to talk about it. In that case, the Nazi Party never got more than, like, 30-something percent of the vote. It didn't happen that way. It doesn't have to happen that way. What has to happen is that they get enough of the vote to get into some kind of position where they can start chipping away at shit, where they can start pushing those boundaries, as we've seen Mitch McConnell do, as we've seen Trump do, pushing the boundaries, going beyond the line that we thought was a line that you couldn't go beyond, crossing that Rubicon. And a lot of people turn their heads and go, aren't you not supposed to cross the Rubicon? And here, instead of Hitler, we'll talk about Caesar. And Caesar's like, what are you going to fucking do about it? And who did anything about it? And the next thing you know, Caesar's a fucking emperor. But, you know, the moral of the story is he got stabbed to death brutally. So, by the Senate. So you never know. You never know where this could be going. The point being, I hope it's clear that even if a minority of the country really supports him, they do support him fervently, and there's enough of an apparatus in place, and there's enough sort of either apathy or reliance on institutions, just belief in institutions. And I think it's very American, too. It's this sort of like, everything will be fine. We're a democracy. The press will shed light on stuff. The justice system will take care of criminals.
There are checks, there are balances.
There's checks and balances. We learned about it in third grade. Checks and balances, it's taken care of. And so even as things go farther and farther beyond the line that we thought was the line you couldn't cross, there's no mechanism to stop things from progressing.
There are mechanisms, but they've all been so compromised.
The point. Yeah.
Yeah. So the mechanisms have been targeted and compromised, whether the mechanism is an educated populace or the mechanism is a robust and richly diversified news media system, which happens along like local news, state news. True. Like that's another thing that has been gone after and compromised. I have to say it's a really miserable time because it feels like what is there to be done. You know what I mean? Because the way that we see it in history, like if we're going to talk about Hitler, is that it gets that extreme. And at some point, the pendulum does swing back. Like things get, but what has to happen along the way for the pendulum to swing back is pretty fucked up.
What I really want to talk about is the psychology of these people who are supporting this. From the, you know, unwashed masses in the red caps all the way up to your Mitch McConnells. What's going on that they are in such fucking lockstep behind this clearly dangerous, deranged, monstrous person?
Not just dangerous and deranged, but fucking embarrassing.
It's embarrassing.
Like, aren't you embarrassed? Like, that's like one of the things when Arnim Sommer was like, can we ruin ruining Trump? Like, all the things that are kind of hilariously grotesque, simplistic, dumb, when like Donald Trump's son, when Fredo, Don Jr., yeah, says after the acquittal, my dad's just like OJ. And you're like, oh my God.
He knows what he's saying when he says that, right?
So what he's saying is OJ killed his wife and got away with it. Right. And you're like, this is so embarrassing. And with the spray tan and the payments to porn stars and the like, just doing everything so badly out of the open, wouldn't you be embarrassed? Like, isn't that embarrassing to you? And it's like, it doesn't matter.
So I want to talk about that.
Okay.
Let's get into it. Why aren't Republicans embarrassed by Trump?
Yeah.
Why aren't they embarrassed enough to pick someone slightly more subtle or competent at being a corrupt and venal dictator?
And one of the things that they've been doing is that there have been so many stories that are like, Republicans are secretly horrified. Have you seen those stories? But the thing is like they think that makes up for it.
Yeah.
Like we need to tell the news that we know this is super fucked. And it's like, yeah, but it doesn't count if you don't do something, my friends. Like it doesn't fucking count if you don't vote the votes.
So a lot of the explanations that we've looked at, I think in past episodes, some of them we may not have mentioned, but like I just want to go over some of the previous explanations that we've mulled as to this phenomenon of being able to rationalize and justify and defend anything this guy does.
Mm-hmm.
The first and most obvious, I think, is at least on the part of the Mitch McConnells and the other people in the Senate and Congress and so forth, is partisanship, right? They have this will to power for their own party. And that is fueled by their corporate donors, the people who finance their campaigns and keep them in their jobs, who want Republicans to stay in power because they want their tax cuts and deregulation and whatever else they think will benefit them. So it's corporate overlords and partisanship, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that explain a Susan Collins, though?
I don't feel like it does because I don't think the corporate donors are doing what McConnell does.
No, I always assume he's doing what the corporate donors want. That it's essentially like, it's just sort of axiomatic. Republicans are good for our business. We want Republicans in office because they will lower corporate taxes. They will lower taxes on the wealthiest people. They will deregulate.
I mean, I think the other part of it is like, it's Fox News.
Yes.
They are watching Fox News, which is, they're getting a distorted idea of what the country wants.
It reminds me
of like Dave Chappelle recently was like, I support Andrew Yang. Mm-hmm. And he's like, $1,000 a month will help people with healthcare. And you're like, you are so rich. You do not even remember what $1,000 a month does for most people and what it can't do for most people.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's a super lack of perspective that comes with like the Fox Newsification, where Fox News was supposed to be about like, undoing liberal bias, but now it's this bizarre echo chamber and they don't understand.
It was never about undoing liberal bias. It was always about Rupert Murdoch creating his own state-run media, so to speak.
It was, and it has gotten to the point where the state-run media has become what is listened to so much.
Oh, yeah.
That there's no other voice, so they don't know.
There's a direct dialogue between Trump and Fox. Like, he watches Fox and tweets about it. He gets his own talking points from them, and he gives them talking points, and it goes back and forth. It's like a dialectic. But it's not just that Fox News gives politicians a distorted idea of how much support there is, but it also reinforces and creates support for Trump. I think that explains to Susan Collins, who's actually in a position where she's like, if she looks like she's going against Trump, she's screwed. Because, like, when Mitt Romney voted his conscience, you know, supposedly, in the Senate trial, the next day they were ravaging him.
Well, okay, this is something that I think gets to that thing that we've looked at. And it comes back to actually that thing that I wrote about Manafort.
Yeah.
And about the whole cuck thing.
Yes.
How the right-wing use of the term cuck, which means cuckold.
Yes.
And anybody who even negotiates with the left wing is a cuck, is a cuckservative. Like, that's the language that they use for it, right? Like, he's a cuck. And it's like they're experiencing anything that is not their dominance as a sexual violation.
Mm.
That's what's so nuts about it. I wrote this thing where I said, in this worldview, all that matters is white superiority demonstrated through white male ownership of white women. And any other kind of compromise, even political, gets experienced as a sexual violation.
That's brilliant, Maya. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think it actually incorporates another explanation for this enthusiasm around Trump and defending Trump, which is racism.
Yeah.
There's clearly this like intense tribalism. There's this culture war tribalism. There's this like the liberals, the radical left, they're so horrible. They want to take our guns. They're attacking our way of life. And that's also tied in with they want to let in the immigrants with the brown skin who are going to ruin everything. And the implicit thing going on there is they're going to fuck our white women.
Yeah. But it's also this thing where it's like they're going to fuck our white women and they're going to have money and they're going to be successful and they're going to, and we're going to be, I mean, that's what was so amazing about Watchmen when they go to the Nixon trailer park.
Yeah.
And it's like all these white people living in a white trash living in a trailer park, just being like sitting there being racist. It's like, there's this last stand, this like Custer's last stand mentality.
Oh, absolutely.
Where it's like, we're on the verge of a new world. And I think for a lot of us, that new world is like super exciting. For me, I'm like, we're on the verge of a new world. We're like majority minority. It's like, woohoo.
So
like,
exciting. It's so great. But for a number of people, it's terrifying. And I think that for them, Trump is this avatar. He's an avatar of strength, which is just weird to me because he's so clearly the biggest pussy you have ever seen. He's so weak and vulnerable and thin-skinned
and embarrassing and incoherent. Like, it's so
But
also, well, let's take a second. Okay, hold on a second. How did this happen with Trump and not with W?
Well, that's sort of key to what I'm asking here. We saw a hint of this with W. We absolutely saw a lot of the gaslighting and the GOP's reality bubble forming during that era. We saw they started to have their own perception of everything, of what was going on. They were the sky was a different color in their world. So that was happening then. But W was an old school corrupt politician. He still kind of pretended on the surface. He played the part. He tried to, as best he could, play the part of like a normal politician. He wasn't so blatantly I mean, it was pretty blatant. It seemed very blatant at the time, but, you know, the standards for blatant corruption have just gone far beyond calculation at this point. All right, so it's difficult to explain. These are all obviously factors. I think the far right, the religious right's super fervor about anti-abortion is also a factor in that they will, like, excuse anything if it means they will get Supreme Court justices that are on their side.
Yeah.
That's, like, their only thing, and that's part of it.
Totally.
And I think, as I've talked about, I think, on previous episodes, there's just the sort of cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias. I think we're seeing an incredible display of it. And for those who've forgotten or didn't hear previous episodes, just really briefly, cognitive dissonance is the phenomenon where people feel really uncomfortable when you're holding two cognitions in your head that are contradictory. Cognitions can be thoughts, beliefs, knowledge, information, whatever. And so what we tend to do is try to resolve that discomfort. And that usually means denying one of them. It usually means saying, well, that one must not be true, which would be like confirmation bias. What I want to believe is true. What I don't want to believe is not true. Though there are other ways as well, like adding more information to the one that you want to believe. Like, okay, yeah, Trump's a jerk on Twitter, but look what he's doing for the economy. And you add all the good things you think he's done. You know, that's those are all forms of dealing with cognitive dissonance. And it's particularly strong when the cognitions you're talking about go to the person's core beliefs that pertain to their very identity and their sense of self, which takes us back to the culture war issue and the racism issue, right? If your core sense of self is like, I am a truck driving, gun toting, real American, whatever, then you're not going to want to believe anything that might suggest that there's a problem with your way of life.
Right. Which, I mean, look, we all do it, right? That's what our friends do for us. We, I mean, like, our friends are like, you're right, he is a jerk.
And we all do it politically, and we all do it in all avenues. We all have cognitive dissonance.
It's so bizarre to be living in a moment where you know that the majority of people don't agree with that, and yet this other side feels so unbeatable. It's really, really weird where you're like, 18 million more voters were on the side of impeachment. And that and that actually, like, I would be, if I was a Republican politician, I would be worried if I saw the numbers. I'd be like, ooh, that doesn't look good.
Maybe I should, you know, separate myself from this.
Yeah.
You know? You might even call this level of loyalty religious.
Yes, and we've talked about this in terms of cult behavior.
Yes, we
did. Part of what a cult does, and actually I was talking to somebody about this and they said, oh, gangs do that too. You have to do something that makes you cross a line. Because once you've crossed that fucking line, you're in.
You're in.
And you're in past your own sense of right and wrong. So that's like gang initiations. That's what cults do. What a cult is going to do is make you do something so beyond the pale that after that, you're all in.
And it's a matter of community and identity, but I think it's also this matter of faith. And we had a really interesting series of tweets from a listener about that. And that's what I want to get into in our next segment.
So we have a great listener, Megan Danzig, who wrote to us this amazing series of tweets. And she said, regarding talking with Trumpkins, she says that as a graduate of a conservative evangelical seminary, there's a philosophical concept no one knows about in the right-wing zeitgeist that could help here. Megan, thank you. And she says, presuppositional apologetics is a method of, quote, defending the faith, which deliberately eschews logical and evidentiary methods. They rely on the assumption that everyone's starting place is axiomatic. It's irreducible and basic. So, for instance, faith and truth of the scripture. What most presuppositional apologetics look like in practice is a constant deflection of the accusation against the faith back at the accuser.
That's Sounds familiar.
Right. So basically what's happening is in the right wing and in right wing conservative evangelical thought, there's this idea that evidence doesn't matter. Quote, logic doesn't matter. Unless you start with where I'm starting, it does not matter.
Right. I believe this because I believe it. It's faith, and you believe what you believe, and you can't logically argue faith.
Right. And actually, she said this thing's amazing. She said, her theology professor put it succinctly, they are dead, we are alive. There is no common ground. Like, we don't even have to listen to what those dead non-believers think. Because they are not, we're not even in a world where we can have the same conversation. Because our basic prepositions of the world are not the same. So we never have to acknowledge what they think.
And she adds, Christian theology is prime for making people vulnerable to absurdity. Mm-hmm. And she talks about the Trinity and how it's absurd on its face. And this whole idea of faith and Christian theology priming people to simply accept things that make no logical sense. And Megan wrote, this is one of the several reasons I am not surprised by evangelical support for Trump, despite his rape and racism and lies and cruelty and idiocy. Trump support is now axiomatic, a presupposition, a baseline for their arguments. Thank you, Megan. That was incredibly insightful and really opened our eyes because I had not heard about this particular concept of presuppositional apologetics, though I've obviously observed it.
Also, can I just say, fucking wicked writing. I mean, like, well, like a laser, like, shoo.
Well done. Very nicely done.
Megan, nice.
I think this is really interesting. And I would argue that it applies beyond evangelical support for Trump and goes to like small e evangelical support for Trump. Mm. Like people who are Trump evangelists, not evangelical Christians who support Trump, but people whose faith is in Trump.
Right.
That seems to be where they're operating from. And I think we've talked about this on the show in the past, but it makes me think of, you know, all of Trump's fake news and all of his insistence, every story about him that is in any way unflattering or negative is fake.
Yep.
And any person who criticizes him or reveals unflattering or bad information about him is a liar. The good stuff about him is all true. The bad stuff is all lies. Even the photo of his orange face is, oh, it's a Photoshop, which it was not.
You know what else it reminds me of? So you know how I had this like longtime obsession with that amazing O.J. Simpson documentary? There's this moment where they're talking about how the prosecution started their testimony by talking about domestic violence and about O.J.'s history of domestic violence. And I remember one of the lawyers being like, they didn't seem to understand. And Marcia Clark was like, they understood. It's not hard to understand. They just didn't care. And there's something about that that's like so stays with me. Like they laid it all out. They had the phone calls where he's screaming in the background. She's terrified. Like they understood. They weren't dumb. They saw
they
it.
Just didn't
they
care.
Just did not care.
You could say the exact same thing about the Senate and the GOP electorate regarding the Ukraine call and all of the doings that Trump and Giuliani did there. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
They know it's true.
Yeah.
They don't care. That's what I was getting at with talking about like the fake news thing is that I don't believe that people who are loyal to Trump actually think the New York Times is lying all the time. I don't think they actually think that the FBI has been, you know, controlled by the deep state and that everybody in the Mueller investigation is against him. I don't think they really believe that, but I think that they think everyone is liars. Everyone is, I mean, that's obviously what Trump thinks. Everyone is as bad as he is. So he's their liar. It's okay because he's their liar. Everybody believes what they want to believe. I mean, I've seen this, you know, in my years of having online arguments.
Right.
And you present facts and statistics and information. And sometimes they'll respond with like, yeah, facts can prove anything.
Or one thing I've noticed with a lot of like my dad's friends where when they're and I know I've mentioned this before, when they're criticizing a Democrat, it's on the values. And when I'm like, but what about the Republicans who have done these big, terrible things? They're like, oh, well, all politicians are corrupt. And you're like,
yeah, that's my dad too.
Interesting. Interesting. When you're criticizing Democrats and the people I support, there are all these real values you adhere to. And when I say, oh, look at your people, you're like, well, all politicians are full of shit.
But that's a classic cognitive dissonance coping strategy.
Right. So that's what it's like, that same thing. And it, you know what? It just makes me think, because I'm trying to sit here. I'm like, we're in this moment. And I'm trying to think about like the cognitive dissonance and belief of like white supremacy during slavery. I'm trying to go to history.
Yeah.
There are these people who are enslaved and are doing all of this labor really well that you don't want to do. So you don't value it as labor, even though you value it, obviously, because it's like bringing you money and resources. Like,
yeah, but you value them as like chattel.
Right.
There's a monetary value.
Right.
There.
But it's also thinking about the ways that like now when people do tours of plantations, they're like, look at this beautiful architecture and craftsmanship. And it's like, who did that fucking work, guys? Who
people,
did that fucking work?
People have their weddings at plantations.
I know.
That boggles my mind.
So, but it's that thing where it's like, in what way can you appreciate and admire the craft and skill and talent and then deny personhood? Do you know what I mean?
No, I do see what you're saying. That is a kind of cognitive dissonance. And I think that's really kind of the history of the United States.
Right.
Is really steeped in that. It is a history of people having to rationalize contradictory beliefs or actions that contradict their beliefs or a state of society that contradicts their values. There's always ways to rationalize. I think that kind of explosion of truth and of values and that very selective application of values where it's like, how dare Nancy Pelosi tear up that piece of paper? That is just awful. You're like, are you fucking serious? But then, of course, the myriad things that Trump does that are really horribly offensive, there's always an excuse for it. There's always a reason why it's not a bad thing. It's
right.
Always fine. It's the core of the way fascism works. I know I'm kind of a broken record on this. I always am going back to this, but that's how fascism works. It's about faith. Fascism asks the followers to accept the leader with pure faith and to build their very identity around their membership in the party. And that is the axiomatic, fundamental, irreducible truth. And nothing else matters. There's no penetrating that with logic or reason. There's no penetrating that with reality. That's how it works.
First of all, I would like all of our readers to go to the LA Review of Books because I just put out...
Our listeners.
I would like all of our listeners...
Although, we probably should have text version. If anybody is willing to do transcripts, because we do not have the time.
We do not have the time.
And we cannot pay you, so I'm sorry. But
or
hey, listeners, if you or someone you know is willing,
so
reach out.
All of our listeners, I just published... I can't believe I didn't bring this up earlier, because it just came out a few days ago. My colleague, Maura Brewer, and I just wrote this pamphlet that got published on the LA Review of Books about mutual criticism, which is this ritual of group identity formation that happens in utopian societies, where the individual gets criticized by the group for how they are or are not keeping up with the standards of society. So okay. We wrote a brief history of mutual criticism, which goes from the Oneida, who are the like utopian Bible communists of the 1850s, to the present day. We track 150 years of mutual criticism.
It's a thing today. Who's doing it today?
So now you see it because of this cult called Synanon that was like initially a cult that formed around.
What a great name for a cult.
I know, right? So Synanon was originally a cult that developed around helping people get over their drug addictions. And they did a version of this called The Game, which was this really, they would call it attack therapy, where they would like,
Jesus Christ,
you'd be in a circle and people would just fucking attack you. And then you were encouraged to fight back so that they could then destroy your defenses. And it's still the basis of a lot of tough love drug rehab in centers that are happening right now. Like all of the major drug addiction.
Is this research based?
No. Oh, no. Synanon was not research-based. It was like cult leader doing his thing.
But if it's being used in drug rehab?
Yeah, it's not very effective in the opioid epidemic. Let me just tell you, there's it's not very effective.
Oh,
but
if only you could criticize people out of their opioid
addictions. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and actually, a lot of the sort of hardcore sort of, you know how parents will do that thing where they're like, my son is so troubled, I'm going to kidnap him and send him to this, all based on Synanon. They're all Synanon alums who started those organizations.
Oh,
and they're not very effective, but okay. So, so the People's Temple did a version of it called Catharsis Sessions, where people would come and get completely criticized for being capitalist, individualist, only caring about their own shit. Jim Jones had this plank of wood that he called the Board of Education that he would
That's really clever, Jim Jones. I gotta give it to
him. That he would beat people with. You see the use of mutual criticism tactics in Bolshevism, in Maoism, and then it came back to the States because every cult and intentional community and commune had a copy of the Little Red Book. And it's this idea that you're constantly bettering yourself by constantly criticizing yourself and your community.
No, by constantly getting criticized.
Also by constantly getting criticized. But when you look at Jim Jones and you look at the values that Jim Jones was promoting, which was basically a fully racially integrated society where the least of us, the poorest, and the most vulnerable are cared for. The elderly, the people of color are cared for. And you see how much you would want to believe in that value. The extreme of what you're willing to do to get that to happen is extreme.
Yeah. Look, I'm still not voting for Bernie, okay?
Okay, fuck Bernie. Fuck Bernie.
I will do a lot. What's the Meatloaf lyric?
I would do anything for love.
I'll do anything for Medicare for all.
But I won't do
that.
But all I'm saying is there is a way that this cultist extremism is what we're in. And the only question is if we're looking historically, where does it end? When does it turn? And the answer is nowhere good. It's either Hitler killing himself in a bunker, or it's a massive civil war. The times when it's gone that extreme. And so I feel like we're on this train and it's going and it's not good. It's not good. So what do we do right now? It's we're trying to intervene before the really horrible thing happens. And I feel like we're kind of on this ride until the really horrible thing that turns it happens.
Yeah, because our culture and our government institutions and our social institutions don't really have a recipe for that. There's no clear set of steps you're supposed to take. It's all sort of founded on the expectation that things will balance out and take care of themselves and that the institutions will hold. And we don't have that set of instructions what do you do when the checks and balances don't work? What's
break
the next
glass
set of checks?
Here? Break, you know,
the Constitution doesn't have
when
that.
When you read about the history of the gulags in the USSR and how horrible they were and the long-term impact of the gulags, they're people whose whole lives happened during that stretch of history. So whatever horrible corruption the gulags were, whatever horrible part of government they were a part of, it just had to see that through.
Yeah, that's another thing. You realize all throughout history, things like this have happened and people have just had to keep on going on and they just had to live their lives.
So when you think about, like, on the one hand, Hollywood really does have actual power, worldwide power. And Hollywood said Parasite is Best Picture. You know what I mean? And on the other hand, we're on this train of horror where it's like, maybe there will have to be civil war before we're done. And it's at the same time. And it's very weird.
As long as Canada is there and
we can move to it.
I'm just saying, my only real goal here is to recognize the situation and get my ass across that border before I'm in a Handmaid's Tale situation, literally.
Yeah, that's but all. The men in our lives wouldn't Handmaid's Tale us, right?
No, that's in the Handmaid's Tale, she's running for the border with her husband and child when they get caught, right? Yeah. She just waited too long.
Yes.
She could have got there earlier, but, you know, like always happens. She was like, this will be okay. This can't possibly go in that direction. Hitler's a joke. He's ridiculous. He's never going to be chancellor. Okay, he's chancellor, but what's he really going to do? You sort of accept each next step in the progression. And all I'm saying is, I want to know, what's my signal? What's my clue? What's my flag?
To
the
run.
Red flag that's
to
like,
run.
It's like, actually pack up your shit and go to Canada.
All right, guys. We're all thinking of moving to Canada. Maybe you can join us and we'll form a commune where we'll do mutual criticism sessions.
I like that idea. Mm.
Listeners, we haven't moved to Canada yet, but you might want to support us in moving to Canada. We are thinking about it.
It'll be costly. So if you're interested in contributing to our either video episodes,
yes,
or some more long-form multi-episode deep dives, or possibly fleeing to Canada, any of those possibilities we're going to need a little bit more money for. So please visit us.
Patreon.com/saucepodcast.
At all membership levels, you get to join our Discord community where we talk about the stuff we talked about in episodes and any other stuff we want to talk about and current events and pop culture.
We have the best listeners in the world. They're amazing. All really fucking smart as shit. So like,
and
come on.
There's also bonus material that we post there. Check it out. Also, if you have thoughts about anything we've talked about, or if there's other stuff you'd like us to ruin, by all means, reach out. You can find us on all the social medias as @saucepodcast. You can email us as saucepodcast@gmail.com.
You can find me at Maya Garance, anywhere you're looking for Maya Garances, if you want to see my freaky images of road tripping around North Carolina.
Oh, God, you guys got to check out Instagram. Just check out that Instagram.
And that way you have a link to my pamphlet on the history of mutual criticism, so that when you are forming your post-capitalist, post-apocalypse communities, comrades, get in
I'm
touch.
Doing it.
Yeah, come on.
You can find me as @gynostar, GYNOSTAR, on all the various platforms.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Adios, amoebas.